You are listening to episode 14 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Class Who, and this is the GNU World Order, my little show about technical and Linux and Unix and geeky stuff like that. This is actually technically episode 15, because I actually have a episode 14 recorded already, but it's an interview with Lost in Bronx, and I have been away for so long that I decided that coming back with an interview might be a little bit cold, so I wanted to meet with you in person and talk, you know, have a chat just among you and me, and we'll bring in Lost in Bronx for episode 15. So, let's see, Self has just happened, and by just I mean probably 3 weeks ago now, and I'm back from Southeast Linux Fest. I had a whole bunch of interviews that I was really, really excited about. I'm talking about really cool ones. Alan Hicks from Slackware, Vincent Batts from Slack Builds, really, so Alan would be from Slack Book, I guess. Pat Volkerding, the founder of Slackware, had him interviewed by me, and a whole bunch of other ones. FreeDeb from, well, formerly of FSF, and now she's working on a different project, which is really cool. All this cool stuff, and I got back, and it seems like all the files, all but three, are blank. They're just empty files. How did this happen? Well, I had concerns about my battery life on my Nokia N800, which of course is my de facto interviewing and podcasting device. But the battery's getting a little bit old, and I figured, well, if I take that and try to interview, I'm going to be looking for power outlets every, you know, 15 minutes, and I'm not going to get any interviewing done. And so I figured I should take my professional recorder, the Zoom H4N, which is a great recorder. It sounds fantastic. It's an unbelievable quality. It's a great thing, and I use it for all the professional recording that I do, whether it's for myself or for jobs or for a movie shoot or whatever. So I mean, it's really, really high quality. It's great. The battery life is phenomenal. So I took it and was going to use it and used it for the interviews. Well, turns out that I guess there's a button on the front of the Zoom H4, and it's labeled mic, and then there's a 1 and a 2. And the 1 and the 2 refer to line inputs, line 1, line 2. And the mic means use the built-in microphone. I guess I must have hit the microphone button, or rather the one or the two buttons, and accidentally switched the recording input to line input. Of course, I didn't have anything plugged into the line input, so that didn't really work out. It's really puzzling to me why Zoom would place a button of such importance right there on the front of the unit. I mean, you might think, well, gee, that means it's easily accessible. Well, yes, it does, but the problem there is that it's so easily accessible that you can hit it by accident. And if you know the workflow of someone doing recording, it's very rare that someone's going to have instant access to switching which input they're using. I mean, think about it. You're on a movie set, you're recording an actor. If the thing is mounted to a boom pole and you're holding it over their head like a boom mic, you're not going to hit the button and switch to line inputs. And conversely, if you're recording from a soundboard, then you're not going to switch back and forth between the onboard mic and the line inputs, right? I mean, that really is something that you could justifiably bury in a menu somewhere that is very hard to accidentally hit. Unfortunately, it's right there on the front, and I guess I hadn't really handled the thing as much as I had as much as I did at Self, and I must have hit the button by accident. Now, there is a hold switch on the unit. You can turn it on, and then you can flip it up to hold, and I guess I need to start using that more. Either way, the bulk of my interviews from Southeast Linux Fest, and there were a lot of them, and they were really, really good, they're all lost. They're gone. So, I've kind of come to terms with that. Too bad, but there you have it. That's the Southeast Linux Fest news. On a less depressing note for Southeast Linux Fest, at least it's depressing to me. It might not matter to you, but for me it was depressing. But better news from Southeast Linux Fest, it went really well. It was a fantastic festival. There were a lot of people there. There was a lot of good stuff going on. And I gave a talk there on a subject, which I'm going to get into in a moment. Had a lot of great audience participation on that talk. It was just a really good festival. There were a lot of great talks. If you've never been to Southeast Linux Fest and at all possibly can get to it next year, you should definitely try to make that happen. It's just a fantastic festival. There's so much Slackware and Red Hat / Fedora stuff going on there. It's just like, it's a little slice of paradise if you use Slackware and Red Hat / Fedora, which I do. So let's get on with the show. it would seem that Linux Format Magazine did a review of a bunch of podcasts, including HPR and Tilds and things like that. I don't usually really like reviews because I don't find them usually very interesting, actually. I mean, I like to discover new things, but I don't really like to hear what someone else thinks of something because I don't really know that person and their opinion doesn't really sway me one way or the other. But Linux Format Magazine apparently did some reviews of some podcasts. And apparently I get some kind of mention. The GNU World Order is mentioned. Not reviewed, but it is mentioned. Interesting. I wanted to also thank publicly, here in the show, Ken Fallon for sending me a Pogo plug, which is a small, low-powered server-type deal meant as a backup. I think we reviewed or talked about Pogo plug on either Kernel Panics or Linux Cranks. It's just a little embedded sort of Linux device that you plug into your wall, and you can plug, I think, a hard drive into that and have it be sort of an NAS, a network-attached storage for your home, is their idea. But I'm going to try to put something else on it, like armed Slack, hopefully. That should be fun to play around with, so thank you, Ken Fallon, for that. And Ken Fallon also sent me a Nokia N800. Apparently it's the Nokia that he won from Lug Radio, back when Lug Radio was giving away the Nokia N800, which I know I remember. You may remember that as well. And I think the contest was depicting yourself as high off the ground as possible or something like that. I'm not too sure. It was kind of hazy, but anyway, it was a little on-air contest, and Ken Fallon won, and he sent me the N800. I don't actually know why, but I appreciate it because now I've got a backup battery for my N800, and I've got a backup N800 itself. So that should make sure that I'm podcasting for, I don't know, at least 6 more seasons. I mean, I've made it this far with this unit, so possibly longer. So that's good. Thank you. Also, someone whose name I've completely forgotten, like completely, gave me a bag of Kona coffee, and I'm really, really appreciative of it. He gave it to me at Southeast Linux Fest, and it comes from Hawaii. I mean, obviously Kona coffee comes from Hawaii, but I mean, the bag itself came from Hawaii. He was actually in Hawaii on vacation and brought me back a bag of Kona coffee. I have to admit, and I mean, there's probably some Hawaiian listener or sympathizer out there who is going to cringe, but I don't actually love Kona coffee sort of straight. I love to mix it in with other stuff. I'll make a blend, Sumatra coffee and Kona or something, or Colombian and Kona. Basically anything and Kona. And that generally speaking tastes really good. But in terms of like just making a complete cup of Kona coffee, that tends to be a little bit intense for me. That said, I haven't really tried a Kona, for instance, cappuccino or espresso. Sometimes I actually like the stronger coffees more when they're served as a cappuccino or a latte or an espresso, interestingly. So anyway, this Kona coffee is really, really good. I've been cutting it with other stuff a lot. There's a really good coffee that at the local cafe sells called Yurgachev. I think I might have mentioned it before, and I've been buying that a lot lately, and I mix the Kona in with that, and it's really good. You know, heck, I mean, since we're talking about coffee, I might as well mention I got a really nice French press for my office. I used to have this horrible machine that someone had given me, and it was a really appreciated gift, but it just didn't make any good coffee. It didn't make good coffee. It was really, really bad. And I did try to use it. I tried to use it because someone had given it to me that was nice, you know. I mean, I didn't ask for it. They just, out of the kindness of their own hearts, they just gave it to me. And so I wanted to try to give it a fair go. But in the end, the quality of the coffee just wasn't any good. So what I did was I got a French press, and in the past I've had trouble with French presses because they're typically made out of glass, and I don't know if it's the temperature, you know, when you're pouring the boiling water into this glass container that has not been hot previously. I mean, that tends to crack glass, or if it's just age and it gets old, or if it's, I'm just too rough with it, I don't know. But I always break them. I always end up breaking my French presses. So I was really looking for a French press that wasn't glass. And someone in IRC referred me to some brand. I think it was by Bodum or whatever that one company is called. And it was like, I don't know, 50 or 60 or 70 bucks. It's a little bit much for a French press, I thought. But it was metal. But I looked around a little bit more, and I found on Tiger Direct a French press made out of metal by Thermos, the brand Thermos. Heck, we all know Thermos. We know and love Thermos, right? Well, I bought it, and sure enough, it lives up to its name. It's metal, won't break, and it insulates the coffee, not spectacularly, because it's not an airtight lid or anything, but it keeps it hot for certainly a lot longer than one of the traditional glass French presses ever did. So that was really cool. And I get to use my bad coffee machine as a hot water heater, so everyone wins. But yeah, if you're looking for a French press, check out the one by Thermos. I know it's at Tiger Direct, probably some other places too, and it's really reasonably priced. It's more like $20 or $25. Okay, let's talk more about Linux. So at the Southeast Linux Fest, I was going to do a talk about Auteur. Auteur is, of course, the video editor that I'd started as a series of in-player shell scripts, and really I had been using it for one of the classes that I teach. I needed a way to edit little clips and stuff, and I was using that, and it was working for me just fine. And after I talked about it, I think on this show or something, Rowan Golfer picked up on it and actually just rewrote it in Python with PyQt. So that was really getting exciting, and it was looking really, really promising, and it was working, and it was a good little project for a while, and I got pretty excited about it, and I pitched a talk about Auteur for the Southeast Linux Fest, because at the time, Southeast Linux Fest was months and months away, so I thought, well, surely Auteur is going to be incredible by the time the festival rolls around. I mean, it's going to be a complete Final Cut killer by the time Southeast Linux Fest happens in July, or June, whenever it happens. So I pitched this talk, it got accepted, and somewhere in the middle there, Auteur kind of evaporated. Rowan Golfer had to go work on real-life stuff like OpenMolar 2, which, by the way, not that I understand much of it, but it really is coming along great. If you're into open-source dental scheduling and billing software, definitely check that out. But I hang around in OpenMolar, the IRC channel sometimes, and Rowan Golfer is always mentioning some cool feature that he's just figured out how to implement. So it is an exciting project, even if you don't understand it, but at least you kind of understand that cool Python coding is happening. So so Rowan Golfer went away to do all that stuff, and Auteur just kind of like bottomed out. It just kind of stopped. I tried for a little while to reverse engineer what Rowan Golfer had done, plus still trying to teach myself Python, and it just wasn't really going that well. So Auteur effectively died, and shortly thereafter, the Indiana Linux Fest happened. Of course, Indiana Linux Fest is the one put out by, or kind of started by Lord Drakenblut, and I think, Suso, of course, and probably the whole little Indiana lug, I think. But that was a great fest. I really enjoyed that one. And at that convention, they actually asked me to fill in for someone who couldn't give a talk that they were going to give. And I said, okay, well, sure. What was the talk on? And they said, well, it's on Kdian Live. Thought, well, great, Kdian Live. I haven't looked at that in months, so I didn't give it on Kdian Live. I just gave it on my own brand of video editing tools, which was at the time InPlayer in the shell, in the terminal, and Blender. And the talk went really well, and I went home after Indiana Linux Fest and kind of thought about Kdian Live. Turns out the guy who was going to give the talk about Kdian Live is a videocaster. He does This Week in Linux. I'll try to include a link in the show notes. I watched a couple of his episodes, and I thought, wow, this is really cool, and he uses Kdian Live for this. How is that possible? And, you know, I've seen videocasts done really well with video tools that I wouldn't necessarily want to use myself. I'm thinking, of course, of The Source by Aaron Newcomb. He used to use Cinelera for it, and I was just not impressed with Cinelera ever. Couldn't get into it. Not at all. So the fact that this guy was using Kdian Live didn't quite convince me that Kdian Live had really developed all that much. But then, like, the next week, there was a news story on .kde, which is the KDE news source. There was this news story about how Kdian Live's hosting had been moved over to the KDE servers. It hasn't been incorporated into KDE proper, like the KDE compilation, that's the set of KDE applications, but it's closer, you know, it's in the same, it's on the same continent now. And so at this point, I'm thinking Kdian Live is everywhere. So I finally decide to check it out, download it, I install all the dependencies, and it's very particular about the dependencies. It requires certain versions of certain codecs and a toolkit called the MLT toolkit, and it's very particular about the dependencies. You need certain versions of certain codecs and things like that, so you really, it's not an easy install still. But I installed it, and I have to say that there are a lot of people online making it very easy. If you know, back when I first tried KDN Live, it was an incredibly difficult install. It was you had to change distributions to find one that actually had gotten it up and running, you know? So the fact that I was able to do this on my normal Slackware system, I kind of thought, well, this is very promising. I fire the thing up and I'm floored. I'm absolutely floored. It has every single feature a video editor could possibly want in the real world. And I say in the real world because when you think, okay, what's a video editor? What does a video editing application need to have? Well, such an open-ended question, right? I mean, you could have the basics of video editing. All you need is something to play the video and something to record where to start and stop. That's the basics of video editing. But the other end of that spectrum, well, we need built-in compositing things, we need titling, we need effects, we need title sequences, we want the ability to offline our footage, we want the ability to convert to a DVD straight from the timeline, you know, all these different things that you could invent and say, well, that's what a video editor might want to be able to use. Well, a video editor might want to use anything, the kitchen sink. A video editor might want the kitchen sink for some reason. So, I mean, there's no limit, right? And yet, at the same time, of course, you don't want to just say, well, hey, it cuts footage, what more do you want? So KDN Live is just that perfect balance. It sits firmly where Final Cut Express essentially sits. And Final Cut Express is a program that I both love and I hate, because I love it for what it is. I hate it, first of all. But I like it because it is, even though it's a proprietary application and I'm not going to actually use it, but what it represents what a video editor needs and what they some of what they want. Now, the reason they only give the video editor some of what they want is because they decided to sell a cheaper version of Final Cut Pro by removing, you know, two-thirds of the features, and they hand it to the video editor for a cheaper price. Some of those features are absolutely, in this day and age, essential features, you know, things that they shouldn't have ever taken away. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it, other than being crippled, it also represents the pragmatic view of what a video editor would realistically want to have on a very capable editing system. That's what KDN Live represents. It's got everything that a video editor really actually needs, and it's got a whole lot more, actually, if you think about all the codec support, some of the effects that it offers, and some of the bells and whistles that it's got. But if you're just looking for a solid video editor, professional grade, KDN Live is there. If you need something a little bit more, KDN Live is there as well. If you need your dream video editing environment, which has built-in, fancy compositing, 3D modeling, integration with animation and 3D titling and stuff like that, Blender, I still think, is the future. I still think that Blender, if somehow I could learn to code C++ and Python overnight and take on Blender, then I think that could be Autodesk smoke killer. I think that would be truly the bloatware to please all video editors everywhere. It would just be a fantastic application. As it stands, however, that's not the direction Blender's going. I'm not going to learn how to do C++ and Python anytime soon, and KDN Live exists right now, and it works, really, really well. The newest version is 0.8. In my opinion, it should have probably just gone ahead and bumped it to 1.0, because it is that significant a change. The last time I tried it, I think, was 0.7. I think it must have been at 0.7 for a long time, but I think it probably did a bunch of 0.7, 0.4, 0.7 point dot releases. This is definitely a 1.0 release. This is the best video editing program on Linux that I've ever seen, and it absolutely murders Final Cut Express. I can't imagine why anyone would want to use Final Cut Express over KDN Live. KDN Live has more codec support, more effects than Final Cut Express. And the only real thing that sets KDN Live apart from Final Cut Pro is the bloat. Final Cut Pro has a lot of bloat. Some people use some of that bloat, just like some people use the bloat in Photoshop. Many people do not. So you've got KDN Live, you've got Final Cut Suite. Realistically, most people are just using the KDN Live part of their big fancy Final Cut Pro Suite. So KDN Live is exactly what, probably even more, what GIMP is to Photoshop. It's probably exactly what OpenOffice is to Microsoft Word or Office, at least as far as I understand that difference. It's a solid standalone video editor that rivals its its equivalents over in the proprietary world at this point, with the only real significant argument against it being little things that you just got used to in Final Cut Express, little features that you decided you had to have or you just couldn't ever use anything else. That said, if you go get hired at a post-production house and they're using Avid, suddenly you're using Avid all day. And I think the same would hold true if some post-production house was using Kdian Live. I think people would switch over pretty easily because it is a fantastic application. Just unbelievable. I've been using it for about a month now. I've been doing, I started out with light projects expecting it to crash every 3 minutes. It just never crashed. So I started trying different things, really more complex projects. So now I'm actually editing a real project, a documentary project on Kdian Live, and it's got separate soundtrack and video. So the video and the sound were not actually recorded on the same device. That's how films are usually actually recorded. You don't actually get sound on your film strip, for instance. So it's very similar. So you're having to marry sound and video together. There's a lot of cuts. There's a lot of stuff going on. And it's working like a charm. It's unbelievable. Real-time audio mixing, effects that you just wouldn't believe. It's fantastic. Kdian Live has delivered Linux video editing to Linux. So keep an eye on that. Recommend it. It's the real thing. Staying on the multimedia track, I guess, there was some talk about color management in the talk that I gave on Kdian Live, mainly because the projector that I was using in the talk and the computer screen that I was looking at were very different. They looked completely different, so I was trying to show color correction in Kdian Live, and it was just completely different results on the projector. And I made some comments about this, and actually Paul Frields from Fedora spoke up and mentioned a project that was happening, I think, in the GNOME desktop right now, but it's, I think, making its way into the free desktop specification or whatever, so it should hopefully get rolled into KDE as well. But it's something to bring true color management to Linux systems. Color management is a big topic, and it's something that I might even do an HPR episode on at some point. It's actually such a big deal among a lot of the graphic artists, and mainly graphic artists, to be honest. I was going to say and video artists, but not really. It's more of a filmed video concern. That group of people really, really think about color management. Well, they might not think about it, but they seem to base a lot of their decisions on it. So much so that I think it's my perception, and I could be wrong, but it's my perception to a certain degree, the popularity of Macintosh in the design space actually owes a lot, I think, to color management, to ICC. Now, there's a group that came out with a way of managing colors on computers and different devices, digital devices, and the group is called ICC. That's the International Color Consortium, and it was founded by Adobe, Apple, Microsoft. Okay, just wanted to get those names out of the way early. Silicon Graphics, so SGI, Sun Microsystems, now dead, of course, but they were alive then. Taligent, which I've heard of, I just don't know what they actually are. Fogra, F-O-G-R-A, and Agfa. Agfa, if you don't know them, they do a lot of film work. They're big in the celluloid film space, and I think they had some scanners for a while as well. But these groups of companies founded this committee, the ICC, International Color Consortium, and decided that they needed to come up with some kind of industry standard for an open, speaking of Apple, Adobe, and Microsoft, of course, that's kind of funny, open, vendor-neutral, cross-platform color management system so that, and this is the part that no one ever seems to get to, it boils down to making sure that when you look at an image, it looks the same on every device you look at it on. So if you've got a photograph that you took with a film camera, you got it printed by a developer, you look at it, you like it, you scan it in. According to the ICC and what they're going for, when it gets scanned into your computer, it should look the same on your screen as it does on that hard copy that you've got. And then if you send it to your printer, it should print out and you should hold that printed copy and your photograph that you got from the developer. You should hold them next to each other and they should be completely the same. So it's all about making sure that your images look the same on every single device that you look at them on. This is actually somewhat built in nowadays to almost every device and every application that you're going to use, at least on a semi-professional level. If you take a digital photo with a camera, and you send it over to your computer, you open it up in GIMP, chances are GIMP is going to ask you, hey, I've detected an ICC profile or a color profile or color space in this image. Do you want me to keep that space, that color space, or do you want me to convert it to your current working space? And typically, you would want to keep that color space. And that will interpret the color values in the way specified by that little profile on that camera. And there's a couple of big ones that you'll hear about. There's sRGB. That's a really, really big one now that it's computer age and everything. I mean, it's always been a computer age, I guess, since the ICC has been around. But it's an important one because that's the one that HTML and web browsers define as their de facto color space. So sRGB is a big one. Another big one, in my perception, is the Adobe profile from, I believe it is, 1998. So there are a couple of profiles that vendors typically seem to kind of latch on to, maybe just because they're popular or maybe they're widely supported elsewhere. sRGB, Adobe, those are two of the big ones. More often than not, it's something that we don't really notice. And it's only in the bigger kind of workflows that you're going to actually have to think about ICC profiles, meaning that if you're a designer and you've got another designer and you're doing the graphic side of some image and this designer is doing the photo retouching of an image, and then you're going to marry those two parts together and composite them into a movie poster or a magazine cover or something like that, then, or just a piece of digital graphic art, then you would want both of you, the designers, to be working in the same color space so that when you put them together, they don't look like they were completely taken on different days, different devices, and don't even look like the same picture. You want them to be the same. Now, you can always convert, of course. The risk there is that you are taking a color space that has more potential colors in it and compressing it into some kind of color space that doesn't have the same color depth. That's obviously something that most people in the industry of graphic design and photography and stuff like that would want to avoid. So the point is, the short story is that ICC color profiles exist, and if you get a picture in from someone and it's got an ICC profile attached or embedded within it, then you can convert to that ICC profile, and you're telling your application to interpret those colors in the same way that those colors were originated. To that end, I figured I should mention that actually Linux has fairly good support for ICC profiles. It's located in the /usr/share/color/ICC folder. You can drop ICC profiles into that folder, and they will be available to certainly GIMP. You can go to the image menu, go down to mode, and you'll find assign a certain profile or convert to a certain profile, things like that. There's support in it with Krita and Inkscape and all those major sort of graphic-y kinds of Linux applications. So the support is there. For improved support, support is there, and you can actually, I did a Slack build recently for the Adobe and ECI ICC profiles. Those are some of the more common color profile sets that are out there. So if you are running Slackware and you want to get a Slack build of it, feel free to download that. I created it with the option to either turn on or turn off the Adobe profiles just in case people wanted them. Although, in truth, Adobe is one of the more common ones, so you'd probably want that if you're going to bother getting the ICC profile pack. But Thrice in IRC actually helped me figure that out really nicely, too. So it's kind of a joint effort on that one. So for improved color support in GIMP, like I say, it's got great ICC support already, but if you want to take that a step further in GIMP, you can install a really cool plugin called Separate Plus. A little plugin. I wrote a Slack build for that as well, so if you're running Slackware, you can install it from my Slack build. And it's a little program, installs itself into the image menu all the way down at the bottom, Separate. And what it does is it takes RGB and converts it to CMYK. And it's a really cool thing that you can do. You can convert it to CMYK, and you'll actually see all the colors as they are separated out into layers. And you'll see them, and you can click them on and off and actually see the values and see how they multiply on top of each other to create different colors. It's really cool. But even more cool than that, more useful in my mind, is the soft proofing feature, meaning that if you know that you've got a printer sitting off in the corner and it's an Epson printer, and you want to see what your picture is going to look like once it's converted for that printer, it will emulate that on your screen. It's really, really nice. And there are color profiles for different paper stocks, for different printers, for different monitors, for different cameras, different scanners, lots of different profiles out there. So if you download the profile and then you Separate Plus to emulate what it's going to look like, you'll get really interesting results. And you might be able to tweak the color temperatures and the values a little bit so that you're optimizing it for your device. So check out Separate Plus and, of course, ICC Profiles in general. Yes, this is pretty good stuff. French Press, Yurgachev Kona Custom Blend. It's a good day. It's a good cup of coffee. Hope you're enjoying yours as much as I am mine. Okay, time is almost up, so let's get back into it. Okay, interesting little tip called VLOC. So back at some, I think it was Ohio Linux Fest, maybe a year ago, I saw Drew Levine from the PCBSD project give a talk on, I think, BSD, probably. Anyway, she mentioned this cool little tool to lock your console, meaning that, you know, if you've started your computer and you're running Slackware or FreeBSD or something that doesn't necessarily automatically launch X for you, and you're maybe you don't start X, you're just typing in the console, and you decide to go get a cup of coffee. If you were in a GUI environment, you'd just start the screensaver, and then if someone came up behind you and tried to get into your computer, it would prompt them for a password, so you're locking your session. On the console, there's not really a way to do that, right? Unless you, like, exit, but what if you don't want to exit? So the way to lock it would be to get a program that would somehow lock that session unless you provided a password. And she mentioned it, and I completely forgot the name of the program, could not for the life of me figure out what it was. And then just by chance the other day, I was looking on Slack builds for something, and I came across this program called VLOC. That's V as in virtual lock. And I thought, wow, that sounds kind of cool. Has the word lock in it. It must be leet. So I tried it, downloaded it, and installed it. And it turns out it's the exact program I think that she was talking about. So VLOC is very simple to execute. You simply are in your virtual console, and you decide you want to get up for a cup of coffee, so you type in VLOC. Suddenly, you are left at a prompt. I think that it blanks the screen and gives you this little prompt, and if you try to type anything in there, it simply says you can't do anything until you give me your password. And then once you give it the password, it lets you back into your console session, and you're typing away again. So it's a really, really handy little tool. One of those little tools that probably every box should come with it pre-installed, probably. But if not, you can download it and install it really, really quickly. Slack Builds has it. Debian has it. Fedora has it. Red Hat has it. So, I mean, I think it's probably fairly well proliferated. It's just not necessarily pre-installed. So check VLOC out if you ever use a virtual console and get nervous about not being able to lock that session. VLOC is the way to do it. I realize I'm about a half a decade late on this topic, but yeah, apparently there's something called virtualization, and apparently it was the new big thing, like, 2 years ago. Everyone was really, really into it. I never could really quite figure it out because I was always trying to play around with virtualizing things on a little laptop, you know, that just didn't quite have the power to really give me a true operating system and, you know, experience in my virtualized machines. So it didn't really work out all that well for me. But I've always been a fan of QEMU, so much so that I think I even mentioned it way back when this was still in Macintosh podcast, like in season one. So I've always been interested in QEMU. I've liked it. I've really been fond of it. It's cool because it emulates processors. It's lightweight. It's really kind of nice. Well, not too long ago, the place that I work bought a new server, and it's an HP ProLiant with about 8 gigs of RAM and lots of processors, and, you know, it's kind of the latest, greatest server on the HP line. I mean, not the high-end stuff, but it's a good little server. And it suddenly dawned on me the other day that probably if anything that I've ever had the ability to really, really virtualize something, that server probably did. So I went in there and checked, and sure enough, it's got the ability to virtualize. And so I decided to finally look into real virtualization. So if you've got anything that is a recent computer, like something with an i7 chip in it, and probably even less than that, but let's just say i7, for instance, that kind of multi-core chip, chances are you've got the ability to do a pretty nice virtualized environment on that CPU. And there's this big deal called KVM, and I've heard of that, and I've never really understood what it is. I still don't actually understand what it is, but I do know, to some degree, what the big deal is. KVM allows your computer to kind of do this hybrid virtualized machine. Instead of just taking an ISO and firing it up into this little fake computer, it makes that fake computer half fake and half real. So part of that virtualized environment is using the actual hardware on your computer and the actual low-level programs that your computer is running, meaning that it doesn't have to recreate fake versions of all that stuff. So your virtual machine itself is taking up a lot less resources. I probably said all of that pretty badly, and it's probably technically, there's probably something in there that I said wrong, but that's kind of the idea of it, that this virtualized machine is now taking advantage of stuff that's already running anyway, just so that you can have a desktop in the first place in real life. And so instead of recreating all that stuff again for your virtual machine, it's reusing a lot of that stuff. So KVM is a big deal because you're cutting that overhead in half. To verify whether or not you've got the KVM ability on your CPU, you can do an EGREP, that is EGREP space dash C space single quote paren VMX type SVM paren single quote space slash proc slash CPU info. If that returns some number greater than zero, then yes, you've got the ability to do the whole KVM thing. For more information on KVM, you can go to linux-kvm.org. That'll give you a full list of all the supported CPUs and answer a fair amount of questions. I read a fair amount of that page and still came out not 100% clear on what it all meant, but it did increase my understanding. So if you've got that in place, then we can play around with virtualization. And of course, the only names I really knew in virtualization were QEMU and VMware and VirtualBox and Xen. And there's probably one more in there. But anyway, the big ones that I kept thinking of were like, you know, when people talk about virtualization, they always talk about VirtualBox for playing around and then VMware for the hardcore real life stuff. I don't know anything about that stuff. I knew that VirtualBox, I think it was, seemed like a pretty hefty install. It was not trivial, and this isn't something that I need to do for real, so I was like, well, do I really want to go to all that trouble? And I'm not even clear on the licensing of that thing now. I can't ever figure out if it's exactly open source free software, or if it's more like core source or whatever they call it, where they're kind of giving you some stuff and keeping the good stuff proprietary. And then VMware, I think, is proprietary. I don't really know. I don't really care. It's not something I'm all that interested in. And it turns out that Red Hat and Fedora and probably Slackware and probably Debian too. I didn't check it on Debian, but they've got stuff going on for virtualization. And so it's a pretty easy thing to set up. You just do a yum install libvirt, libvirt, vert manager, virt-manager. And honestly, I think that's about it. You can also do libvirt-python, libvirt-client, and python-vert inst, and vert-top. Those are all interesting add-on tools. But the main one is libvirt and vert manager. Those are available certainly on Fedora and Red Hat and in Slack builds. So between those distributions, I can say for sure you're solid on the virtualization stuff. Install those tools, and then you'll need to start the libvirtd daemon. So if you're on Fedora, service space libvirtd space start. I did this on Red Hat 6, RHEL 6, so that's why I'm kind of giving you the Fedora / Red Hat commands. I did install it on Slackware, and I just haven't gotten around to actually using it yet. But I did install it from Slack builds just to make sure that it really did install. And sure enough, it all installed. So service space libvirt d space start, and then your virtualizing engine is sort of running. If you don't have QEMU installed, you'll want to install that as well, because it's actually going to use QEMU as the engine to drive the virtual machine. Turns out there's a really nice little GUI front end to all of this. It's called Virt Manager, VIRT-Manager, and it's a GTK app, and it seems to work pretty darn well. It's a really nice looking little application. To access it, I simply, first I had to log out of my server because I hadn't logged in with X-forwarding, and then I SSH'd back in with X-forwarding, so SSH space dash capital Y CLATU at migrateserver.local, whatever. And then it signs on, and I start up vert-machine, vert-manager, rather. It's really pretty self-explanatory after that. You simply create a new machine, and you can define how it's going to be installed, whether it's going to be over Pixie boot or network install or an existing disk image or an ISO that's on the drive. You can define where it's hosted. So in this case, it would be hosted on the local host because that's where it's actually running. You can define which Linux it is, how much RAM you want to assign to it, how big of a hard drive you want, you know, all the normal stuff that you would do in, for instance, QEMU on the command line or in VirtualBox in their little setup wizard. Pretty straightforward kind of virtualizing stuff. It installs it as usual. You can step through the Anaconda installer or the Incursus installer, whatever you're doing. It'll install it onto your little disk image, and when it's finished, you'll have a virtual environment that you can run. The little virtual graphics card that it uses isn't the best in the world. I'm not really sure on the details on how I would improve that. I wouldn't be virtualizing something that required really, really high resolutions, for instance. But I have to say it's a great start. The speed is fantastic. It's more what you'd expect from a virtual machine. I'm sure there's a lot more to do, talking about like thin clients and things like that. You can really divide up the resources, of course. So there's a whole world out there that I haven't yet experienced or explored at all. But if you've never done this, if your only experience with VirtualBox or with virtualizing is VirtualBox or VMware or something like that on, you know, your laptop, give this a shot. Give a proper virtualizing experience a try, because it really is, it makes a completely different experience. And hosting it on the actual machine. I mean, I'm hosting it on the server, so I'm networking into the virtual machine. Doing it on your desktop right in front of you, or your laptop if you've got a really nice powerful one, could be a completely different experience. It's really fun to play around with, and you know, KVM and libvirt and vert manager is kind of nice, because at least you know that this is free software, properly respecting all of our different computing freedoms and things like that. So it's really fun to play around with. I can't speak for how it's going to work with shared storage and dragging and dropping out of the virtual window into the non-virtual, out into the host, and all these other fancy things that people sometimes talk about when they're talking about virtualizing and stuff. But in terms of just firing up a fake machine inside of your real machine, this is definitely the way to do it. So check it out if you have not yet.
This is Linus Torvalds, and I pronounce Linux as Linux.
No matter how you pronounce it, we're celebrating 20 years of the kernel at Ohio Linux Fest 2011, September 9th, 10th, and 11th at the Greater Columbus Convention Center. Catch us at ohiolinux.org.
Well, I think that's probably the end of the show. Wanted to mention really quick, since it's only a couple of months away now, Ohio Linux Fest. It is in September, so you should go to ohiolinux.org. Check out the site, register, and try to get yourself over to Ohio Linux Festival this year, because Southeast Linux Fest is fun, so is Ohio Linux Fest. It's a really great time, lots of people, lots of talks, lots of information, and it's just a really great weekend of all the stuff that you truly, truly love, meaning computers. So I hope to see you there. I will certainly be there. Be sure to say hi if you haven't already said hi. Or if you've said hi in the past, you can still say hi again. And yeah, I'll see you later. This has been episode 14 or 15 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. I'm Klaatu, and you can reach me at notklaatu@jabber.org, or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org, or klaatu@member.fsf.org, and you can find me on IRC, in the channel Ogcast Planet, or Slacker Media, or Slackware, or OpenMolar, a couple of other places. My nick is not Klaatu. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next time.
He was blind and wearing a red plaid shirt.